PPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an online hybrid doctorate of education in organizational leadership on campus in West LA with attendance only twice per term. gsep.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Firefighters are gaining the upper hand in the Woolsey fire. It's now at 47% containment. So that's some really good news. The next worry, though, is rain. We'll hear about that weather forecast a little later in the show. Plus, the Los Angeles Rams will be back in town Monday night. The team will pay tribute to everyone affected by the victims of that horrible shooting in Thousand Oaks last week and the wildfires that continue to burn. We'll be talking about that coming up in just a bit. First, though, the vote count continues to pour in, and there are many races that are still too close to call. In the 45th district down in Orange County, a mere 261 votes separates the candidates, with Democrat Katie Porter taking the lead over Republican Mimi Walters. The 39th district also remains extremely tight, with Republican Young Kim taking a lead on Democrat Gil Cisneros. For a little context, though, on why we still don't know the results, we called up Paul Mitchell, Vice President of Political Data, Inc. That's a bipartisan voter data firm in California. Paul, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Historically, have we gotten this far past an election in California with so many races still this tight?
Well, not with so many high-profile races. I think that's what's different here is we have kind of this happening on a national stage with a lot of attention being paid, particularly to these races. There's also some other lower-tier races like a Board of Equalization seat in Southern California that's extremely close. And also at the state level, the Superintendent of Public Instruction race statewide was as close as a couple thousand votes yesterday. So a lot of races this close, and but we've seen this before in 2014 as an example. In the primary, the race for controller went all the way to the end, all 31 days after the election.
Wow.
And it was finally decided by 481 votes.
Oh, my God. That is razor thin. I mean, just as razor thin as it gets. Now, Paul, as the vote counts come in, they seem to be swinging more Democratic. Is there a reason for that?
Yeah, it's actually the elections in California have this strange time function, where the earlier voters are the people who are homeowners, older, traditionally more conservative, and then the people who show up at the polls or drop their ballot off at the wrong precinct or mail it in on election day or have to do a voter registration on election day, those tend to be more renters and younger and more minority. And so those older, whiter, conservative voters, their ballots are literally counted first. And so when we saw the initial results in all these congressional races, the Republicans were up 6 or 8 points.
Yeah.
And since then, it's just been, trickling towards the Democratic side.
So especially in California, then, Paul, I guess the advice is election night numbers don't mean quite as much.
Election night numbers are traditionally high watermarks for the Republican candidates, and it's about them being able to have enough of a lead to sustain it.
We're talking to Paul Mitchell, Vice President of Political Data, Inc. That's a bipartisan voter data firm in California. Now, I know California is really big, Paul, but why is this taking as long as it's taking? And Washington State wrapped up its count a few days ago.
Yeah, so Washington State is a perfect example of another state that has really advanced how they vote and encouraged people and actually mandated people to vote by mail. But in Washington State, it's all vote by mail. There are no polling places. So there's nowhere on election day to go to your local polling place and drop off your ballot. There's nowhere to vote at an actual machine or polling place. There's nowhere to do a provisional ballot if for some reason your registration was kind of missing or do a same day registration. So we have polling places and people are dropping off ballots and all these signatures need to be verified, all these provisional ballots need to be verified, and that's what takes so long.
So the role of mail-in ballots, how much of a role have mail-in ballots played in this delayed vote count for us here?
A huge role. These mail-in ballots don't just get opened at the county registrar and tabulated like when you vote at a polling place and you sign the register when you actually go in person. So they have to verify who you are. That signature can be verified either by the record that they have at the registrar. It can be looked at and compared to your driver's license record. Or in some cases, they'll contact voters and say, hey, this signature doesn't look right. Do you want to come in and fix it? And so that is what takes so long.
And it can get annoying, right, for a lot of people that want, you know, the society, Paul, that we live in. We want results for everything immediately.
Absolutely. And it is interesting. There is this push and pull, essentially, between the idea of making sure every vote counts and making sure that reporters and people like me can tell you who won. but honestly, it's really lopsided. The value really is on making sure every vote counts. And if reporters have to, wait a couple weeks to be able to announce a result, that's probably a price worth paying.
And this lag time, though, there is, right, a lag. When someone decides to put in their vote, and then when it's finally counted, what is typically that lag time?
Well, it depends. I mean, I jokingly said on Twitter that California is the only place where you can vote on October 6th and not know who won until December 6th. So,
wow, 2 months. Wow.
You know, you don't know the results right away. And for some voters, like if you are showing up at a polling place, and this happened to my mom in the primary. She showed up at the polling place, and for some weird glitch, her name wasn't even there on the little register, so she had to fill out a provisional ballot. So her ballot not only had to be tabulated, but they had to first make sure that she was who she said she was a registered voter, that she wasn't voting somewhere else, and all those steps create this lag time.
All right, come 2020, people will have 11 days to vote, and there will be fewer polling places. Wondering, do you think that'll remedy the situation we're in right now with it taking so long to know results?
Yeah, so where I live in Sacramento, we've converted to this vote center model. Everybody gets mailed a ballot more than 30 days before the election, and then these vote centers start popping up, you know, 10 or even 4 days before an election, more vote centers will pop up. And people can go vote in person. So it allows both the benefit of everybody getting a vote by mail and everybody being able to go to a location if they want to on election day or before. That will probably add to this lag as more counties adopt that process. Mm-hmm. LA County is set to adopt that process. And that should have a huge impact on the turnout in LA County when every voter receives a vote by mail ballot.
All right, Paul Mitchell is the vice president of Political Data, Inc., a bipartisan voter data firm in California. Paul, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
All right, moving on. It could take months for investigators to determine the cause of the Woolsey fire. But Southern California Edison has told state regulators it had a so-called disturbance on a circuit at its substation in Chatsworth 2 minutes before the Woolsey fire broke out nearby. And in Northern California, there have been reports of a malfunctioning power line in the days before the campfire ignited. That fire is now to blame for 48 deaths. Some victims have now sued the utility PG&E, according to the Associated Press. Electric utility equipment starts at about 10% of all wildland fires in California, but they can be responsible for up to 1.5 of the acres burned. That's got some people questioning whether the big utilities have done enough to reduce the risk. KPCC's Sharon McNary has more.
Alex Tombelli was packed and ready to evacuate his home near Santa Paula after the Thomas Fire broke out last December. He climbed up on his roof to take a quick look before leaving. But to the north, he saw a second fire.
Fire paramedics, what's the address of the emergency?
I just witnessed a large flash, and immediately afterwards, flames started catching a tree on fire.
His 911 call alerted dispatchers to the second ignition point of the Thomas Fire. The state hasn't yet determined an official cause, but Southern California Edison's power equipment may have been the source of that explosion. Edison International CEO Pedro Pizarro acknowledged as much last month in a conference call with investors.
SCE believes that its equipment was associated with this ignition.
Ventura City and dozens of burned-out residents sued Edison for negligence. They say its failure to cut back vegetation and maintain power lines caused the Thomas Fire. Edison responded to the Thomas Fire by announcing plans to spend nearly $600 million upgrading its system so it's less likely to start fires. It's already begun the work. Like here in rural Owanga, outside Temecula, it's a high fire risk area, replacing the bare power lines with new wires covered in three layers of tough plastic.
You got it grounded? Yeah, we proved it.
Workers in truck-mounted sky buckets carefully attach ropes to de-energized power lines, preparing to cut the wires and string new ones.
Take a hunch, Sandy.
Yeah, go ahead.
The company wants to replace 600 of its 10,000 miles of power lines. Bill Chu of Southern California Edison says the covered power lines provide
Very robust protection against potential for ignition resulting from palm fronds and tree branches and metallic balloons that gets blown into the line.
That's right. SoCal's ubiquitous palm fronds and errant metallic balloons can take out our power grid and set the hillsides on fire. Another step, Edison is adopting a more aggressive tree cutting program so branches can't fall onto power lines. It'll replace some wood poles with fiberglass ones. Edison also wants to vastly expand its network of small weather monitors mounted on utility poles in high fire risk areas. It already has several dozen, and it wants to install 800 more. Here, a dozen miles to the north, near some horse ranches between Temecula and Hemet, Edison contractors check a pole-mounted weather monitor.
Relative humidity, 53.7.
Dew point, 49.03.
Bill Chu says the monitors record temperature and relative humidity, wind speed and direction.
Wind is sort of the holy grail of weather prediction.
Chu says all that data can help Edison decide when and where to shut off power circuits so they can't start a fire on hot, dry, windy days. LA attorney Patrick McNichols represents Thomas fire victims. He says the improvements are needed, but that big utilities should have started this work long ago.
I would say it's more of an industry-wide practice, which has been remiss over the last few decades, which is upgrading, updating all the equipment.
Utilities' role in causing massive fires is getting more attention in California. Cal Fire blames Pacific Gas and Electric's power lines for many of the 16 fires that burned thousands of homes in Northern California last year. And PG&E says there was an incident in one of its circuits last week near the origin point of the Camp Fire. It's now the state's most destructive fire. McNichols says San Diego Gas and Electric sets a good example. He calls the work it's done
the gold standard for wildfire prevention when it comes to utilities.
The San Diego utility says it has spent $1 billion since a disastrous fire in 2007 to make the same kinds of grid hardening improvements that Edison is now starting.
Really what should have been happening is that over the years, they should have been implementing these well-known precautions.
Edison wants to pass the nearly $600 million cost of the upgrades to its ratepayers. That works out to about $13 a year per household. In its recent rate increase request to state regulators, the company said Southern California is facing fire conditions that it hadn't expected to see for a few decades. Edison's Bill Chu says the destructive Thomas Fire caught the company by surprise.
Frankly, nobody expected what we saw back in 2017.
Critics say Edison should have seen this coming many years ago. Covering infrastructure, I'm Sharon McNary.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth. Offering an online hybrid format in West LA with attendance only twice per term, tailored for working professionals. Classes start January 7th. Apply by December 1st to be considered for a $2,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Fires have many causes, but drought is one likely culprit. And now there's a new drought measurement tool that could be used to predict fire risk. For more, we've got climatologist Dan McAvoy. He's been working on this with the Desert Research Institute, one of a couple of groups involved in this research. Dan, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right. Now, this index you created is called Evaporative Demand Drought Index, or EDI. In layman's terms, Dan, what is evaporative demand?
So what EDI is, it reflects what we've been calling the thirst of the atmosphere, or basically how much water could potentially evaporate from the surface based on the weather conditions. And so it uses temperature, wind, humidity, and solar radiation. And these are all very important factors to land surface drying, drought, and also fire danger related to drying of the fuel moistures.
So this tool is for measuring how thirsty the air could be or is.
How thirsty the air is and how much water could evaporate off the surface.
Now, okay, EDI, this index, it has drought right in the name. Is the goal to look at the effects of drought or to understand the severity of drought?
More so to understand the severity of drought. It was originally intended as an early warning indicator of agricultural drought in places like the Midwest. But, you know, recent research that we've been doing has been focusing more on the potential to use it for wildland fire risk management, because there's a lot of relation between drying of fuel moistures for drought related to fire and agricultural drought in places like the Midwest.
And that brings it, Dan, here to California. We're going through a lot of fires. Seems like we go through a lot of fires all the time here. When you're using this tool, or when this tool is used in an area like California, does it show like risk everywhere?
It doesn't show risk everywhere all the time. It's very sensitive, actually, to the different weather conditions that I was talking about. You know, if the temperatures or the wind or humidity, or if any of those change in given regions, it'll show different fire risk, which makes it useful.
I'm talking to Dan McAvoy. He's a climatologist. He's working with the Desert Research Institute. Now, Dan, you're working with officials who monitor fires to see if this index can help predict what areas are at highest risk for fire. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so we've been looking to see how EDI and other drought indicators relate to fuel moisture and fire potential. And we've been working with Predictive Services, which is an interagency fire management group. And they found it actually very useful this past summer to identify a number of different hotspots related to fire potential, especially in cases like the car fire and the campfire. Another thing they also found, because it's related to drought, they've been finding it more useful than just looking at the U.S. Drought Monitor, which is a very commonly used map. And so they're going to be continuing to test that, and hopefully they'll continue to use it in the future to look at fire risk and fire potential.
Dan, if we can use EDI to identify fire risk, is there anything we can do at that point to say, okay, that could be a rough area right there, let's try and do something? Or is it as simple as just hoping that there's rain that falls there?
Well, that's kind of what we're trying to get working with Predictive Services. That's kind of when it goes into their hands. Mm-hmm. They've told us that they can kind of use this information to help guide some of their decisions on where to potentially put groups, you know, to stage for fire potential, or once a fire has started, kind of where to send folks on the ground related to the near-term weather that EDI is showing.
When it comes to rain, though, Dan, do we need a little bit of rain or ideally a lot of rain? Because I can imagine that if there's just a little bit of rain, the air, the thirsty air, is going to suck it back up and it's still going to stay dry. So do we need a certain amount of rain for this to work?
Well, right now, especially in Northern California, we need a good wetting rain. And so that's, you know, more than just a little drizzle. Mm-hmm. But we really don't want the other side of that, which is an extreme rain event, which could very quickly and easily lead to flooding in the burned areas.
It's Dan McAvoy. He's a climate researcher with the Desert Research Institute. He's been speaking with us about the Evaporative Demand Drought Index that he helped create and how it might be able to predict fire. Dan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, turning now to football. The highly anticipated NFL game between the Kansas City Chiefs and the LA Rams will no longer be in Mexico City, as had been planned. Instead, the game will be in the LA Memorial Coliseum Monday night. Now, that's exciting news for us here, not just because of the game. It's the Rams and Chiefs, a big one. It's also a morale boost in an area that has endured a horrific mass shooting last week and is literally still on fire. The Rams are giving away thousands of tickets to people affected by those tragedies and their first responders in Southern California. And for more on this, we have Andy Kamenetsky on the line. Andy, welcome.
Hey, how are you?
Good, good. Now, moving the game to Mexico City had been a big deal. What went into the decision to have it back at the Coliseum instead?
The field conditions. It was in very bad shape. It was a combination of soccer games and concerts that have recently been there, as well as a lot of rainfall that just left it in bad shape. There had been reports that players were going to boycott the game. One prominent player told ESPN's Adam Schefter, quote, "It's not fair to risk our health." And the decision was made with the NFL Players Association, in addition to field experts, independent outside experts, and they just decided that it was not suitable for this game to take place in Mexico City.
And there was a Shakira concert too, right?
There just had been a lot going on. Also, too, the field had recently been converted to natural grass to a hybrid, and that there were reports that the conversion itself wasn't executed very well, which would leave it susceptible to, you know, weather or just a ton of events all on top of each other.
Now, a big part of the reason for having it in Mexico City was to widen the NFL's international fan base. A game at the Coliseum can't do that. So is this a kind of a black eye for the NFL?
No, I mean, it's something that ultimately speaks to recognizing the importance of player safety. And, you know, in the case of the Rams, for example, they just lost one of their key receivers, Cooper Kupp, last week to an ACL tear. And, you know, both of these teams are hoping to go deep into the playoffs. They are arguably the two best teams in the NFL, and they don't want to risk player safety. And ultimately, too, if players get hurt during the game, that doesn't create an entertaining game for the fans of Mexico City to begin with.
And one last thing, Andy, because one of the things the Rams are doing, they're based in Thousand Oaks. They're right down the street from where the shooting happened. They're right in the middle of where the fire area is. They're inviting a lot of people. It could be a very emotional night to Monday night at the Coliseum.
Yeah, it absolutely could be. They're giving out tickets to people affected by the fires and the shooting, as well as to first responders. And I was actually in the locker room last week on the heels of their win over the Seahawks. And a lot of Rams who live in that area, because that's where the Rams practice, it's where the practice facility is located, they've really been affected emotionally by this. And to a man, they all said that they feel a deepened connection to specifically the Thousand Oaks community, but just, you know, Ventura County in general. They really want to be part of the process of trying to heal this community through just really what has been unspeakable tragedies.
Andy Kamenetsky, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We heard a few minutes ago about so-called thirsty air and how California could really use some rain right now, but not too much. As the Woolsey Fire continues to burn, we wanted to see when we might expect that rain. So we reached out to Jamie Labor. She's a hydrologist for the National Weather Service, and he says it may be too far out to make any predictions.
One model is saying it looks like it could be windy. One model says it could be rain. So we do see that there's the potential for a pattern change from the windy and dry conditions that we've had. But at this point, we can't fill in those details yet about how much it's going to rain or when it's going to rain. But it definitely looks like there is something out there on the horizon.
Now, in burned areas, rain is a mixed blessing. Harder rains come with increased risk.
If we're expecting some heavy rainfall out of that storm, there always is the risk of potential flash flooding and debris flows from a recent burn area. That risk, it'll be there all winter long because these are brand new fires. And here at the Weather Service, we'll be monitoring the situation and keeping updated forecasts as we go through the winter if there are those kinds of risks from rainstorms.
That was National Weather Service hydrologist Jamie Labor on the chance of rain in the forecast and the risk of mud flows to areas recently scorched by the Woolsey Fire. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Governor Jerry Brown and his successor Gavin Newsom appeared side by side in Sacramento on Tuesday. When asked about the coming transition, Brown said this.
I would say the state's in good hands.
The Browns optimistic, but the handoff has been rough. A shooting and a slew of devastating fires have punctuated the past week. So what might we expect from Gavin Newsom once Brown has left the building? Let's ask Laurel Rosenhall from Cal Matters. Laurel, welcome back.
Thanks so much.
Now, the week has not been an easy one for Governor Brown and Governor-elect Newsom, who had to step in for Brown at one point last week. What have we heard from both of them over the last few days?
Yeah, well, Newsom was acting governor last week while Jerry Brown went on a trip to Texas, and that's when the terrible shooting in Thousand Oaks happened. Gavin Newsom said he wants to go further than Jerry Brown has on gun control. It's worth noting Brown has been somewhat of a moderate on the issue of gun control. He has signed many gun control bills, but vetoed some too. And Newsom, it sounds like, is interested in pursuing some of those ideas that Jerry Brown has vetoed, including possibly expanding the use of gun restraining orders, which basically allow loved ones or people who are close to someone who they feel might be in a bad mental state or danger, they have reason to believe the person is dangerous, to seek a restraining order to take away their weapons. So he didn't, you know, exactly commit to that, but he's kind of giving some signs that he's open to those kinds of policies that Brown has not been.
All right, now let's look ahead now to how the state's leadership will change once Newsom is sworn in January 7th. Jerry Brown's personality is bold and brash. Is that fair to say about Jerry Brown?
I think so,
okay.
Yeah.
Now, Gavin Newsom's personality and leadership, how does his style compare?
I mean, I think he's also bold and brash, but, you know, by his own admission, he has a hard time pulling back. He's said that he admires Jerry Brown's ability to be very kind of selective about when and how much he jumps into negotiations, because his own, you know, Newsom's own inclination is to just kind of pounce on everything. Politically, the two are very aligned. Stylistically, they're really different. I mean, back in the 1970s, Jerry Brown was this kind of monastic young governor who was going to a Zen meditation center in San Francisco and driving around himself around in a Plymouth, you know, all of that. Newsom is a kind of a flashy entrepreneur. He owns numerous bars and wineries. He, according to the New Yorker profile of him recently, has 3 Teslas parked in the driveway of his home in Marin County. Yeah. So, I mean, stylistically, there's no doubt they're different. Brown never had any children. Newsom has 4 children, all under the age of 10. So he's very consumed by family life, and his policy interests seem to reflect that. And then, you know, stylistically, you know, you have to acknowledge, like, Brown's one of his early political crises in the early 1980s was an infestation of fruit flies.
Yeah.
You know, Newsom's early political crisis was his affair with his campaign manager's wife. So while he was mayor of San Francisco. So, you know, they've both evolved over time, but they're definitely starting from different stylistic places.
Yeah, Jerry Brown always talks about how you're in a canoe if you're governing, right? And you got to paddle on one side and the other, and you kind of stay in the middle there. So I'll be interested to see if Newsom continues that paddling strategy.
Yeah, I think that his inclination is to be more, you know, sort of hardcore progressive, but I think that he's probably getting some cues from Brown. In fact, the governor's office released yesterday some photos of them meeting privately together. There were no press in the room. And I noticed in the picture that Gavin Newsom's sitting there with a notebook and a pen. So he's clearly, you know, taking notes from Jerry Brown.
Now, Laurel, you write in Cal Matters that it's been 130 years since a Democrat passed another Democrat into governorship. In other words, Democrat to Democrat for the governor. This could make power transfer pretty unique, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it is unusual. We've more recently had several transfers from Republican to Republican, but the last, I think 4 governors have been flipping and flopping between the two parties. So what it means for Newsom is that he'll face a tension that other recent governors have not faced. On the one hand, he will be expected to follow the path carved by his predecessor. Of course, he also wants to live up to his campaign slogan, which was courage for a change.
Yeah.
So he's going to have to kind of walk a fine line between those two different things. And on the one hand, he's saying that Jerry Brown's legacy means a lot to him. He wants to honor it and protect it. I expect he'll continue Brown's sort of policies on preventing climate change or slowing climate change, and also making big changes to the criminal justice system. Of course, he also wants to define himself and his administration with its own priorities. And he's been talking a lot about things that never seem to be especially important to Brown, such as preschool and universal health care and affordable housing.
Laurel, really quick, what's on his plate immediately right away in January?
First up is the state budget, and, you know, they're working on it together during the transition. It'll be very interesting to see how much the proposal Newsom releases next month reflects his priorities on preschool, healthcare, and affordable housing. And then now with the devastation we've seen in the last week with wildfire, I expect that that is going to be a hot issue for Newsom and the entire legislature next year.
All right. That's Cal Matters reporter Laurel Rosenhall. Laurel, thanks a lot.
Thank you.